Welcome to Torat Imecha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Amy Horowitz, and this week we'll be learning Parshas Chukas. In a sefer all about change, this week's Parsha, Parshas Chukas, is once again about transition. After the trials and tribulations of the previous few parshiot, like the complaints of the mitonanim, the botched quail dinner, the lashon hara of Miriam and then the meraglim, the botched attempt to enter Israel by the ma'apilim, Korach's argument and the ensuing plague, we find ourselves in Parshas Chukas at the end of the Jewish people's 40-year journey through the Midbar. Although the end of our journey is in sight and the borders of the land of Israel are within reach, the trials and tribulations are not quite over. This week's Parsha includes the deaths of all three of our leaders, the actual deaths of Miriam and Aaron, and the decree of Moshe's death following the story of Mei Meriva, the famous episode of Moshe hitting the rock to bring forth water. Moshe won't actually die until the very end of Sefer Devarim, but the decree occurs this week, sandwiched in between the deaths of his sister and his brother, all of which occurs in rapid succession. Reading through the pshat of the Parsha, it seems like Miriam's death was the catalyst for the death of Aaron and the decree about Moshe. Miriam died, and the people panicked at the thought that the well of water she provided for them for the past 40 years was gone too. They complained of thirst. Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron to speak to the rock to bring forth water. Moshe and Aaron rebuke the people for their complaints, and then Moshe hits the rock with his staff. Water indeed flows, but Hashem is angry with the two leaders for disregarding the specifics of his command, and the punishment he delivers is harsh. Moshe and Aaron will not enter the land. Aaron's punishment is fulfilled pretty much immediately after a short detour around Eretz Edom, and Moshe's will be fulfilled once the nation is in good hands with Yehoshua, just before entering the land of Israel. Of course, this is true based on the events of the story, but I'd like to focus on an alternative approach to the deaths of these three leaders and suggest that we need to view this Parsha as less of an ending and more of a beginning. Let's assume for the moment that although the Parsha tells the stories of their deaths in succession, the fact that all three die or are decreed death in the span of just one perek suggests that there's a deeper reason for these three deaths happening basically all at once. The Ralbag alludes to this idea, suggesting that the three deaths were essentially decreed at one time. Although the law of Para Aduma, the quintessential chok, also found in this week's Parsha, teaches us that we don't always need a reason for everything, let's try to determine what might be the reason that Hashem organized events in such a way that the deaths of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam all coincided. The Medrash Rabbah, at the beginning of Bamidbar, associates each of these three leaders with a unique miracle that sustained the Jews in the Midbar. In Moshe's merit, we ate man. In Miriam's merit, we drank water. And in Aaron's merit, we were sheltered by the Anane HaKavod. Now, with their deaths, these miracles are coming to an end. Of course, God will provide water, food, and shelter for a little while longer so that the people will survive until they can make it on their own. But the deaths of the three leaders represent the end of the era of open miracles that began during the escape from Egypt and have lasted for 40 years. However, it seems like the timing of this ending is perfect, as it gives way to a new beginning, an era of hidden miracles that are harder to identify but just as sustaining. This new way of life is going to be essential once we enter the land of Israel, which is why this Parsha represents another transition for Bnei Yisrael, as we mentioned. Although Hashem associates Aaron and Moshe's punishment of being unable to enter the land with the events of Mei Meriva, there really was no way that either of these giants could have ever entered the land of Israel with the people. Throughout their time in the wilderness, the people have relied on their leaders for literally everything, from the water they drank, the man they ate, and the clouds that protected them, to the minutiae of their every need. When they're upset, they complain to their leaders. When they mess up, they ask their leaders to intercede on their behalfs. It's for good reason that earlier in the Sefer, Moshe feels he has to remind Hashem that he's not Bnei Yisrael's actual mother. He didn't give birth to them. In fact, he has played the role of a parent to a bunch of children the entire time. They mess up, they complain, they demand, and Moshe cleans up their messes, eases their feelings, and fulfills their requests. And even 40 years after they've set out on their travels, they haven't matured. Miriam dies, and they panic, turning again to Moshe and Aaron with their anxiety and concern. Now imagine for a minute that Moshe and Aaron are allowed to accompany Bnei Yisrael into the land of Israel. How would they ever learn to fend for themselves? They would never become independent, never develop their own relationships with Hashem, but instead they would continue to rely on their leaders to be their liaisons to God. This would be like accompanying our children to seminary or yeshiva in college. If we did, they would continue to rely on us for all the ways in which we provided for them throughout their childhood. And as nice as that may or may not sound, this obviously can't happen. Hitting the rock or not hitting the rock, Moshe and Aaron simply cannot move on into the next era with the Jewish people. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam were perfect leaders for their time. They each represented a nes nigla, an open miracle that defined the period of wandering in the wilderness. But this era was coming to an end. Living in the land of Israel would demand a more sophisticated relationship with Hashem, one in which God would make himself less obvious, and we would have to work harder to still see his hand behind our sustenance. In a shiur I recently heard from Rabbi Menachem Liebtag, he pointed out that the man is called Lechem Min HaShamayim, and our bracha of Hamotzi Lechem Min HaAretz is purposely phrased to draw our attention to the comparison of the two types of bread. Rav Eliyahu Dessler, in his Michtav Me'Eliyahu, articulates the message. There's no difference, he says, between bread that falls from the sky and bread that grows from the ground, except our ability to see each as a miracle. This will be the challenge of the new era. Upon entering the land of Israel and becoming landowners and farmers, would we still be able to see Hashem's providence behind a successful year of crops? Would we still remember that rain in the right season was a function of our adherence to the mitzvot, as we mentioned a few parshiot ago? It seems the Jewish people were existentially ready for the challenge, even though the stories of Navi demonstrate that they struggled in reality. Following Aaron's death, midway through Parshas Chukas, the people complain yet again. They're getting tired of wandering and are ready to enter the promised land. In response to their complaints, Hashem sends a plague of fiery serpents who kill many of the people with their poisonous bite. Of course, in classic form, the people complain to Moshe to intervene and ask Hashem to stop the plague, and he does. The remedy Hashem orders is for Moshe to build a copper serpent and place it high up on a flagpole for everyone to see. Whoever looks up at the copper serpent will be healed from their snake bites and live. Rav Hirsch explains that based on the grammar of the pasuk, Vayishalach Hashem ba'am et hanechashim hasrafim, Vayishalach and not Vayishlach, that we have to understand this episode a little differently. God didn't send fiery serpents, says Rav Hirsch. There were always fiery serpents around Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar the entire 40 years they traveled. However, without them even knowing it was happening, Hashem was protecting them from even seeing these snakes with an invisible miraculous force field. So why would Hashem remove this force field of his protection now and allow the snakes to bite the people? Rav Hirsch explains that this most recent complaint about the length of their journey is just representative of Bnei Yisrael's whole attitude toward the miracles of the Midbar. They've complained every step of the way. God provided man and they wanted meat. God sent them the long way around to avoid war and they complained about the journey. Within mere moments of losing their water source, they're complaining of thirst. They're tired of miracles. They're clearly ready to move on to a life that's more quote-unquote normal. And so, Hashem gives them a sneak peek of what that life will be like. You don't want miracles, says God. You don't even realize what you're asking for. And he removes that force field, no longer miraculously protecting them from the snakes and scorpions that have been right in front of them the whole time. And they suffer, a portent of the challenge they'll face without miracles once they conquer and settle the land of Israel. So Hashem suggests the perfect remedy, the copper snake on a high pole. What this really means is that they should look up towards Shamayim to remind themselves that with or without open miracles, it's Hashem sustaining and protecting them all the time. Those who looked up and remembered Avinu Shebashamayim lived. This is deeply connected to Moshe and Aaron's sin at Mei Meriva earlier in the Parsha. God instructs Moshe to take his mateh and speak to the rock to draw out water. The fact that Moshe is commanded to take his staff along for the miracle is definitely confusing. Earlier in the Chumash, Moshe is commanded to draw water from a rock by actually hitting it with his staff. So it's easy to understand why he repeated that action here in Parshas Chukas. Again, he's instructed to take his staff to the rock and draw water. Why else would Hashem want him to bring his staff along if not to use it in the same manner he'd used it previously? Perhaps Moshe was supposed to use his mateh the same way he used it during Kriyas Yamsuf. There, Hashem instructed him, harim et matcha, to lift up his mateh like a giant pointer upwards. As he stretched his hand over the sea, it could have appeared as if he himself was powerful enough to perform the miracle on his own. Instead, he pointed his staff up to the heavens, forcing the Jewish people to look upwards and recognize the true source of all miracles. In our Parsha, he's instructed to bring that same mateh, but not use it to hit the rock. Maybe he was supposed to use it once again as that giant pointer upwards, to remind the people that Hashem is our provider and protector at all times. Much like teenagers struggle for independence just a little bit too early, before they're really ready, B'nai Yisrael in their 40th year in the Midbar are signaling that they are ready to begin to loosen the strings that connect them in such a direct way to God's providence. Our Parsha seems to clearly mark the transition between the era of miracles in the Midbar and the new era of normalcy that the Jewish people would face once they entered the land. Then, as now, their challenge would be to seek and find Hashem behind the scenes and continue to turn to him with all of their requests and demands. As we mentioned, the right leader for this new era was not Moshe, Aaron, or Miriam, three gedolim who represented nisim geluyim, open miracles. Instead, this era would be officially ushered in by the leadership of Yehoshua, the moon to Moshe's son, the man on the ground who fought the battle against Amalek in a natural way, while Moshe stood and raised his hands up to Shamayim to again remind us that God was in control of the outcome. This is a reminder that continues to be essential, as we too face the challenge of seeing Hashem's hand operate behind the scenes of our day-to-day lives. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and thank you for learning Parshas Chukas with the OU Women's Initiative.